Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Curious Advantage podcast. This series is about how individuals and organizations use the power of curiosity to drive success in their lives and organizations, especially in the context of our new digital reality. It brings to life the latest understanding from neuroscience, anthropology, history, and behaviorism about curiosity and makes these useful for everyone. My name is Simon Brown. I'm one of the co-authors of the book, The Curious Advantage, and Chief Learning Officer at Novartis. And today I'm here with my co-authors, Paul Ashcroft.
Hi.
And Garrick Jones.
Hi there.
And we're delighted to be joined by business thinker and author, Erica Anderson.
I am also delighted to be here.
Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, Erica. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
So let's kick off. Erica, you've written books that covered curiosity, such as Be Bad First. You've also been published in Harvard Business Review on the topic with your Learning How to Learn article. So let's start off with why curiosity. What is it that made you write about this area in particular?
So curiosity has been a sort of passion of mine for a long time, and especially over the last decade or so, I've really, and my colleagues and I have worked on this a lot, have understood, I think, something that's very lined up with what you've said in The Curious Advantage, which is that curiosity is a huge turbocharger of learning and of change. That if people can be helped to be genuinely curious, it helps them personally, it helps them professionally, it helps their organizations, it helps the world. So not to overstate it, but I just think curiosity is a huge advantage, especially in today's world.
Erica, in your HBR article, Learning How to Learn, you talk about curious questions. Could you tell us a bit more about what you mean by curious questions?
Yeah, as we've explored curiosity over the last decade or two, we realized that a lot of where curiosity happens is inside our heads. That when people are curious, they tend to have what we come to call the self-talk of curiosity. You know that we all talk to ourselves all the time. And when people aren't curious, their self-talk about a topic tends to be dismissive, negative, you know, this is boring, this doesn't matter, I don't care. When people are curious, their self-talk tends to operate in a certain way. And most often, it's in these kinds of questions. And three question stems that we've seen over the years that are associated, strongly associated with curiosity, are how, why, and I wonder. So if you're approaching a topic and you're asking yourself those kinds of questions, how does this work? How will this happen? How did this happen this time and not last time? Why? Why is this occurring now? Why didn't this happen when I tried it before? Why is that important to this person? And I wonder, it's a kind of a what if question. I wonder if we did this, da, 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 da. I wonder how that will be different than this. Those kinds of self-talk question stems are a good indicator that you're feeling curious about something. And not only that, but they can prime the pump for curiosity. You can have yourself ask those kinds of questions to help you get more curious.
We explore that a little in the book around the power of asking, I wonder. And I think it's great to have those other two as well of how and why. There was a story that you told in your article around how, I think, a lawyer friend of yours had used curious questions to actually motivate her in an area that she didn't find interesting. I wonder if you could share that story in a bit more detail for our listeners.
Yes. Yeah, it's a really good example. And it goes to what I was just saying about you can prime the pump of your own curiosity. A lot of what I focused on in Be Bad First about curiosity is how to re-engage your childhood curiosity, how to help yourself become more curious. So in this instance, this woman was being offered a bigger job. She was a lawyer, a corporate lawyer. And part of it was she needed to understand more about employment law, which she had never really investigated. And she said to me, she thought it was the single most boring part of law that she had ever encountered. And so I said, oh, wow, definitely. She's not having that, you know, curious self-talk about this. So she said, I can't even understand why someone would be interested in it. And I laughed and said, why would someone be interested in it? And she said, oh, are you serious? I said, yeah, really. I mean, there are people who are interested in it. Why do you think they're interested in it? And it really engaged her as curious questions. She said, wow, I don't know. I do have another friend, a colleague, who this is his area of expertise. I suppose he must be interested in it. I wonder why he's interested in it. And so just asking that question then, as curious questions do, it catalyzed action. Then she went and talked to him and said, why do you find this interesting? What's important about it? And then the other curious question I encouraged her to ask about it was, how could this be helpful to me? How could it make me a better lawyer, a better professional, better at my job to understand employment law? And that got her too. So part of getting curious is just hooking ourselves. And those curious questions are a really great mechanism for doing that.
Curious questions are so much the thing that gets us into the thing we're most interested in, aren't they? I mean, they're the hooks that take us in. And another hook, I have to say, is the title of your recent book, Be Bad First. And when you talk about self-talk, I mean, it attracts me because my self-talk believes at some level I'm a bad boy. But I think it's more I'd like to be a bad boy rather than I am.
Yes. And the title is intentionally provocative. It's kind of like, wait, what do you mean? What we talk about in the book, and what I really mean by being bad first, is in the book we talk about the four mental skills that I believe are key to learning, one of which, you know, to our conversation is endless curiosity. But the fourth one of those skills is willingness to be bad first, which means willingness to be a novice. And again, it's about self-talk, because when we grow up and get to be expert in some things, we like being experts. And it's often hard for us, especially as middle-aged and older people, to go back to being a novice, to be willing to say, I don't really know anything about this. That's difficult for us. And so curiosity is one of the things that helps you over that hump. If you can go, well, why, tell me more about that thing and get genuinely curious about it, it's less uncomfortable to be a novice.
You describe how today's world requires the ability to acquire new knowledge and skills quickly, and how we must seek to learn. And we need to learn and acquire the new skills that allow us to thrive. Can you tell us more about that? Especially, you know, what are those skills that allow us to thrive?
Well, so the skills that allow us to thrive are coming at us every day. I can't even say what they are. But the skills that allow us to learn, I think, are pretty clearly defined. I talk about them a lot in the book. I mean, it's the core of the book. That the first one, very briefly, the first one is aspiration. That you have, if you're going to learn, the only way you can learn something new is to want to learn it. And fortunately, we can make ourselves want to do things. And a lot of people don't know that. They think either I want to or I don't. And so that part of the book is all about how do you raise your own level of aspiration so that you want to do the things, want to learn the things that you actually need to learn. The second one is neutral self-awareness, that it's very difficult to learn well if you don't know where you're starting from. So we talk about how to have an accurate, neutral sense of yourself relative to the thing you're trying to learn. The third one, which is mostly what we're talking about here, is the idea of endless curiosity, that all of us come into the world as babies with literally endless curiosity. In fact, a piece of research that I did that showed up in my book, there are many neuroscientists who believe that curiosity in babies and small children is a drive. They consider it a drive, like hunger and thirst are drives, that it's necessary for survival. And if you think about it, if you have kids or have been around little kids, their curiosity, which I define as that need, that deep need to understand and master, is relentless. I mean, if you've ever been around a two-year-old or a three-year-old, man, they won't quit. You know, they want to know how it works. They want to try it out. They want to do it until they can get it right. And if you think about it, that's the thing that takes them from being a cute little blob when they're born to being a pretty fully fledged human being by the time they're 5 or 6 years old, you know, and know how to walk and talk and eat and, you know, manipulate their parents. It's amazing. And curiosity is the main driver that moves children into that, you know, understanding and being able to operate in the world. And then we tend to, unfortunately, a lot of us get it kind of socialized out of us. By the time, I mean, I've said that the main difference between a 5-year-old and a 14-year-old is that a 5-year-old is perfectly willing to say, I don't understand this, explain this to my mommy, what do you mean by that? And a 14-year-old is like, nah, I got it. They have begun to hesitate to acknowledge that they don't, right? True. So endless curiosity, as we frame it, is a way of how are you going to re-engage that curiosity that you had as a child?
And is that what you mean by changing the inner narrative?
That's exactly right. So the first thing we encourage people, especially people who really have lost touch with their curiosity, the first thing we encourage people to do is what we call find your curiosity sparks, by which I mean almost everyone, even if they've had their childhood curiosity pretty well socialized out of them, is still curious in some areas of their lives. And often where it shows up, we found, is hobbies, because you can be passionate about a hobby and it's pretty low risk. So you don't feel dumb asking a lot of curious questions.
Yeah.
Like this, I don't know if you remember, but the same woman who was a lawyer who I was talking to, I had her get in touch. I said, what's something you really love? What's a hobby that you love? And she said, swing dancing. And I said, really? And she goes, yeah, I'm just fascinated. It's such a happy art form and anybody can do it. And I'm always watching videos and asking people how to do this thing. And if I did this, would it make it better? I said, okay. What you are saying to yourself, your inner narrative about swing dancing, that's curiosity.
Yeah.
And that was hugely helpful to her.
I saw a beautiful thing today, actually, just reading about 3 different hobbies we should definitely have on the go at any one time. And one is a hobby that allows us to be creative. The second one was a hobby that allows us to make money. And the third one was a hobby that keeps us fit.
Great. And they really kind of fit into your 7 C's, you know, the aspects of curiosity. I think that's right. I think the core, the through line is that we are curious about them. It's great to have hobbies because it really helps us enliven and focus on that inner narrative of curiosity with those questions. And that we talk about it in very practical ways, like curiosity is that need to understand and master. You can notice if you're asking yourself curious questions, but underneath that, it's a kind of itch. When you're curious about something, it's like, ooh. Say more about that. You know, it's a need that you want to satisfy.
Why do you think sometimes people are so curious in their hobbies, this doesn't flow into their work, that they don't bring that same curious question mindset into the work that they do?
It's much lower risk. The way that we get socialized out of our curiosity in public is we don't want to, quote unquote, look dumb. There's another point in the book where I talk about that, where, you know, I was talking to this guy who had just been at a senior team meeting, and one of his colleagues was talking about an area that he wasn't very familiar with. It was social media marketing. And he said, I had a bunch of questions I wanted to ask her, but I didn't want to look dumb. And so I think in that higher risk kind of professional situation where we want to look on top of it and we want to be seen as experts, it's harder sometimes to be curious.
I think for leaders, it's maybe even more so as well. So, if you go from a 5-year-old who finds it easy, a 14-year-old suddenly finds it a lot harder, by the time you make it to whatever age where you're in a leadership position, then admitting you don't know something, going back to being that novice over and over again, can be perceived as really difficult for people. And we sort of dive in the book a bit into the curious leader and what's the role of that. I mean, what do you see the benefits of curiosity are as a leader? And I guess what's hard about it from what we were just saying?
Oh, so many benefits. There's another an article I wrote for HBR.com that I can't remember exactly the title, but it was something about when you're the CEO and you don't know. And the frame I set up was a guy, roughly modeled off of someone that I'd known, a client, who had become the CEO of a publishing company, and he had come up through the edit side. He was a journalist, had been a journalist, and then had been a writer. And so he was presiding over his first meeting as CEO, and the marketing person was giving a presentation about digital marketing. And he realized about 5 minutes into it that there were all kinds of things he didn't understand about what she was saying. And it was a real choice point. In the article, I laid out, okay, you have pretty much two choices at this point. You can pretend you understand her, or you can stop and be curious and be willing to be a novice and say, okay, this is not an area I'm familiar with. Can you go back a little bit? I need to ask you some questions, which is a scary thing to do. And in the article, I talk about all the bad things that will happen if you pretend that you know, and all the good things that will happen if you acknowledge your own need to learn. And the main things that happen, the main good things that happen if you do that as a leader, if you acknowledge your own need to learn and become curious, the first thing and almost the most important thing is you are modeling that for the people who work for you. When I've seen this happen in meetings, when there's a great guy that I worked with for a long time, a CEO who was wonderful at this, and he would stop people and say, okay, pretend I'm a first grader. I literally don't know very much about this. And you'd see, especially the new people in the meeting, their shoulders would go down. They're like, oh, that's the kind of operation we have here where we can actually ask those kinds of questions. That's a relief, you know. So that modeling is really critical. That's the first thing. The second thing is it's the only way to learn. We're in an age now where no one can know everything. And even if you, I'm sure this guy was suited for the job and had lots of capabilities, there's no way you can come into a new job and know everything you need to know. So it's, first of all, absolutely practical to do this. But second, it's so important for you as a leader to be open in that way so that you can learn the things you need to know. It's the only way that you can succeed.
A curious culture is a game changer. What does curiosity mean for you? Follow hashtag CuriousAdvantage and join the conversation.
We had some data from within Novartis around the difference between a leader that the team considers favorable and a leader that the team considers unfavorable, and that role modeling would be a key part of it. And we saw where it had the greatest impact was against curiosity. And there was a 22-point difference between a favorable and an unfavorable leader around curiosity. So that shows that if you're not role modeling, encouraging it, creating a safe environment, then people won't be asking these questions. They won't be wondering why, they won't be speaking up, and they won't be learning and trying new things. And absolutely our research certainly backs that up, that it absolutely has a huge impact.
Wow, that's wonderful data, which I will steal and use. The other thing that's important about it, so there's the, when you do it, there's the positive modeling, and there's the you as a leader can learn and grow. The negative, which I'm sure is partly responsible for that 22-point difference, is everybody knows that you don't know everything.
Yeah.
And so when you try to pretend that you do, your credibility is immediately trashed. Yeah. The person is sitting there going, no, I know that guy was just a writer. He doesn't know about social media marketing. Why is he pretending that he does? You know? So it erodes trust.
And you shift the whole thing into a kind of performance rather than something that's a real interaction.
Exactly.
What are you working on at the moment, Erica?
Oh, the book that I'm writing now, I'm about 3/4 of the way through, is called Changing. And the subtitle is Making Nonstop Change Our New Normal. Ooh. So there you go.
I'm guessing curiosity plays quite a critical part there, because certainly one of the drivers that we talk about for why now it's more important is no one really knows what's coming. You know, we're getting accelerating change, and therefore curiosity gives you a model or a superpower almost, as we talk about it, to be able to navigate through that change.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the core, I'll give you the trailer for the movie. I always try to unpack things down to their component parts, you know, so you can really understand and do something about it. And we've been working with organizations in large transformations and change management for almost a decade. But I really wanted to get down to what happens inside of an individual human being when they successfully go through a change. And the absolute core of that, again, back to internal narrative, is a mindset shift. And I'll say this quickly, but I think this will, as I know you a little bit through having read your book, I think this will really resonate for you, that when people are on the backside of a change, when they haven't, they're not going to do it yet, their mindset about the change and the behaviors that will be required are, generally speaking, how we think about changes we haven't agreed to or accepted yet, is that it's going to be difficult, costly, and weird. And difficult just means difficult. I don't know how to do it, or there are impediments to me doing it structurally or organizationally or culturally. Costly can mean time, money, identity, reputation. You know, it's going to cost me something. And weird just means unnatural. This feels unnatural to me. And if you notice when a change is imposed upon you, if you listen to your self-talk, almost without exception, that's how you're talking to yourself. This is going to be hard, and it's going to make me look dumb, and it just seems odd. I don't know. Why should I do this? You know, yeah. Wear a mask? No, that's stupid. Then what the shift is that allows you to behave differently and accept the change is that your mindset shifts to from hard to easy, or at least doable, from costly to rewarding, and from weird to normal. So once you start to see a change and the new behaviors required as being easy, or at least doable, rewarding, and normal, then you'll do it. You'll change your behavior.
That's right.
And one of the ways to help people as a leader make that shift, or to even help yourself make that shift from difficult, costly, weird to easy, rewarding, normal, is to help yourself or the other person get curious.
Yeah.
How might you make it easier? How might it be rewarding? Why is it weird? What might make it normal? You know,
in the book, we talk about the shift from the pyramid of top-down management and control to this new cloud where everybody's connected and everybody has access to data, and hierarchies are really subverted so much, and leadership has to change so much. And then we were thinking about the COVID situation. You know, within the COVID world, there have been a lot of organizations who've been able to carry on business as normal, perhaps because they were in a digital frame already, or perhaps they had the idea of change being constant already in the culture. And then those organizations that haven't had that have really been caught on the blind side, because you know, it's not easy to change. And we were talking about, you know, so much has been required to pivot very quickly. And yet to pivot, you almost need everybody in the organization to have be ready for that, or to be used to the pivot mindset. And curiosity really allows people to pivot very quickly, because it not only asks them to wonder what the scenarios are that they could move into, but also to test some of the new ones and then be ready to move quite quickly. You want to have the culture of being able to pivot in your system before the requirement to pivot comes along, if you know what I mean.
I completely agree with you. And in fact, in this new book I'm writing, I talk a lot about that. 20 years ago, when a company was going to do a reorg, which is what we all called it then, we all kind of expected that, okay, we're going to lift it up, change it around, set it back down again, and then that'll be it for the next, you know. So in the book, I talk about, yes, we have to get better at going through a specific change, but more important, we have to make ourselves and our organizations change capable, which I think is what you're talking about, so that that kind of pivoting, that response, that like, oh, it's something new, what are we going to do about it? Versus having months of like, oh, this is terrible, and it's costly and difficult and weird, and we don't feel good about it. You know, how do you quicken that shift into, okay, I get it. What do we need to do? Let's do it.
And you spend your days, Erica, with lots of different organizations and companies. So do you see this difference in those companies that you work with, of ones that are, you know, much more progressed in being curious, if you like, and having a culture around continuous learning, and others that are still not there yet? Can you see the differences?
Absolutely. And just as Garrick was describing them, so that those who are not curious, not what I would call change capable, it's like curiosity and slightly larger change capability overall, it's like a lubricant in the system. And without that, everything kind of catches and freezes. You know, it's like an engine that's not lubricated. It just won't operate well. And so what I see in organizations that have been able to pivot well in COVID, they're all ready to move. You said something earlier, Gary, they accept change as the norm. Like, this is what's, it is nonstop. We are going to be changing. It's not unfreeze, refreeze. We're going to have to be doing this continuously. So let's really get curious. Let's figure out how to do it.
Erica, let's ask a couple of questions about you personally, if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. Firstly, what's your definition of curiosity?
I define curiosity as a deep need to understand and master. And the reason master is important to me is because I think real curiosity is very muscular and very practical. It's not just a random intellectual curiosity, which can be fun too. I'm continually looking up things, you know. Mm-hmm. But real curiosity is, I go back to that childhood curiosity. It's when I'm curious about something, it's like, oh, I want to know how this works. I want to know how to do this. This will make me more capable as a human being. This will make this organization more capable. It has a real connection to action.
I love how you define it as something muscular, because it implies it's something that you can work on and train and get better at. Exactly how we think of curiosity, I think.
You're listening to the Curious Advantage podcast, inspired by the book The Curious Advantage, written by Paul Ashcroft, Simon Brown, and Garrick Jones. Subscribe to the podcast today.
And mastery really links to action. And one of the ways that we talk about action and curiosity is about construction. The best way to master something is to learn and to try and do it, and to go in and to fail and to figure it out, but to continually do it to a point where you become a master at it. That for us is true curiosity, and part of what we call the curiosity engine, you know, the relationship between construction and creativity.
Yeah, we're 1,000% aligned. And a lot of times when people say they're curious, it's a kind of idle, non-muscular, non-action-oriented curiosity. Mm-hmm. But I think real curiosity, and it's the curiosity, again, that was born into us as babies, is like, I want to be able to operate better in the world, in this new world that's in front of me. And so, yes, I completely agree with everything you're saying.
Getting out there and doing it and trying it. Erica, what makes you personally most curious?
That is an impossible question to answer, because it changes day to day. No, literally, it's that delta between what I'm capable of and what I want to be capable of. I mean, I get curious when it seems to me that something is going to allow me to operate better in ways that are important to me. And so if somebody says to me, oh, I'll give you a great example. So our business, which is all about coaching and consulting and facilitation and has skill development, you know, for managers and leaders, we've had to, speaking about being change capable, I'm proud that we are, we've had to completely pivot our business over the, you know, March and April and May to be 100% virtual, whereas before it was probably 90% face-to-face. And one of the core facilitations that we do, and it's something we've been doing for 30 years, we have a vision and strategy process where we work with clients to help them get clear about what they're solving for, where they're starting from, what would it look like if it were good, you know, what's their vision for the future of their organization, what are the obstacles they have to overcome, and then the strategies and tactics for getting there. So, and I've done it hundreds of times for dozens of organizations. And so when I was trying to redesign it as a virtual, I realized that there were some, one of the kind of activities, I guess, we do when we're helping people create vision is we do this kind of post-it note exercise where they create the headlines about the future they want to create, put them on a wall, and we mess around with them. And I got very curious about how we were going to do that virtually. So we're not in a room. How are we going to do that? And so that I was deeply curious, because it was the only way I was going to be able to still offer this helpful thing to people. And we found a platform. A platform called Miro.com, where we can do both that and mind mapping, which is another tool we use very well, very efficiently. So, you know, and then once we found it, I was motivated to actually learn how to do it, and how do you do it with the group, and then how do we teach it to the people internally who are certified to do it. So a great example of, I was curious about that because I needed that capability.
It reminds me of when you're talking about children and learning, and we give them, you know, toys and things to play with, where they're creating scenarios of the world. And we know that healthy healthy children, healthy cognitive development is all about allowing them to simulate these worlds and to tell stories about them and to play and to fail and to, you know, go into fairyland and all the things that they require. But essentially what they're doing is laying down patterns of behavior for things they'll need as they grow, you know, and become adults. And I think it's the same thing for corporations. I mean, we need to be able to play, as you say, find solutions and platforms that allow us to play and to put things out there and to figure things out in a way that's safe and in a way that allows us to tell stories that allow us to then put things into action.
I think that's exactly right. Put things into action in ways that will allow us to become more capable and achieve our own versions of the future that we're moving toward. I think that's exactly right. And what I noticed when my own kids were little, and now that I have grandkids, is that the toys they like are the most realistic ones. Like when my son, who is now in his 30s, was a kid, he loved actual real things. Like I remember I got him a set of Fisher Price keys and he used to kind of pretend he was starting the car and pretend he was opening doors. But then I gave him a set of my old keys and he liked that much better because he could actually, he could actually create a world that felt to him like more like the grown-up world that he was trying to emulate and create.
He's moving from the kind of plastic, the simulation, into the partially real. And of course, that prepares him for the real risk, that kind of almost iterative storytelling and learning. What do you think the impact of digital is on all of this and the need for curiosity being bad first, for example, within this new digital domain that we're inhabiting?
The whole advent of digital, which has been hugely accelerated in the last 6 months by COVID, it just makes it more important than ever for us to be curious. I mean, just that little teeny story I told about Moreau.com, there are so many things we need to understand about how to operate and how to operate differently in groups, what platforms to use, what technologies to use. I just think we have to be even more flexible and curious and change capable than ever. Because and this is just my opinion, but I don't think it's ever going to go all the way back to where it was. I think this is a necessary acceleration. I mean, like, for instance, we've seen a lot of our clients now are doing, because they must, are doing leadership training with us virtually. And a lot of them are saying, oh, this actually works, you know? And wow, it's a lot easier to do a 2-hour virtual training for people all over the country than to try to fly them into Dallas and do it that way. So I think, you know, it's not going to stay at 100%, but it's not going to go back to 10%. And so because the world post COVID, it will go back to more normal. I think that many of the things that have been accelerated digitally throughout this period will remain and continue to accelerate. So our curiosity is even more important than it's ever been.
So we've covered a huge amount in a short time, from sort of self-talk of curiosity to curiosity sparks to the role of curiosity for leaderships. If you had to summarize into one thing that our listeners should take away, Erica, what would that be?
So I think the most important thing to take away is that curiosity is learnable and relearnable. Sometimes people think of it as kind of congenital in a way. It's like, that guy's really curious and he has blue eyes, you know, that it's something you're born with and can't do anything about. But what we've learned is that that's just not true. The things that I outline in Be Bad First, and a lot of the things that you outline in Curious Advantage, is it is muscular. You can learn it. You can learn to be more curious. And I think it's such a critical capability that is a really important takeaway, that you can get better at it.
Wonderful. And we would fully agree. And that was one of the things that led us to come up with our 7 C's model around how you can learn to be more curious. So that's a wonderful end to our discussion. Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate you being here.
Oh, you're so welcome. This was delightful. You guys are great and ask great questions.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Curious Advantage podcast. The Curious Advantage book is now available to purchase on Amazon. Stay tuned for the next episode and keep exploring curiously. This podcast is produced by Aliki Palinelli and edited by Jill Damatak-Futter.